Deadwood Soundwave.
Cosmic Void, I'm Biggs.
I'm Xavion.
So today we're covering Big Trouble in Little China from 1986. Why'd you want to pick this movie?
I don't know. It's fun. It's one of those movies that it is a very big hidden gem that no one knows about. And not
anybody. I kind of disagree.
Really?
I think people your age don't know about it. I think people my age, it's like 50%. Like, it's a cult classic for sure. This is like the definition of a cult classic. It came out. It did not burn up the box office. It went largely unnoticed. I remember the trailers for the movie, and then I saw it for the first time at a video store when I lived in Portland as a kid. I'd walk around and they'd be playing it up. So I saw like it in its entirety because my mom would take so long picking out movies.
Yeah.
And then I didn't see it again until a couple years ago. A friend of mine, Sam McIntyre, invited me over to their house with my family to watch this movie. And I was like, oh, this is so great. And like being older and understanding it better, you know?
I agree. I mean, watching it yesterday was definitely like, I was like, man, as a kid, I don't remember this. But it's funny because I guess you're right. Well, I don't know. I feel like I've asked some people where I'm like, have you ever heard of this movie? And they're like, no. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think when you talk about like Generation X, you're talking about like a 50% hit ratio as to whether you know
it or
not. I can
see that. Yeah, fair enough.
But if they know it, it's probably from home video. It was not seeing it when they were a kid or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like, it just did not do well.
We watched it on, well, when I was young, we watched it on VHS. That was my mom's favorite movie.
I think your mom's an Xer, right?
Yeah, she is. Nope, I can't give her information.
You can do it. I'll cut it.
Okay. But yeah, my mom introduced us to this movie. And let me tell you, as kids, you kind of go, oh, all right. Yeah. And then the more you watch it throughout the years with your mom, and she's like, this is my favorite movie. This is why. It's almost nostalgia after a while. Like, yeah. Nostalgic. I'm like,
Well, it's got this thing that I grew up with that my friends and I would do all the time, which was we'd watch these little movies that nobody knew of.
Yeah.
And it would have one crazy scene. And it was at a time where I think it's a little bit different now. I think there's higher awareness when you go to watch a movie for the most part. Most people don't just pick a thing they've never seen. Sometimes you'll go off of the cover, but I think most people know something about the movies that they're watching.
Agreed.
This was at a time where like stuff was on TV all the time and you just didn't know and you didn't have that many options to file through either.
Yeah.
So it's like you would roll the dice on movies, and when you saw one that had like a crazy scene, you'd be like, dude, you got to watch this. This dude like blows up. I mean, like literally blows up like a balloon and then blows up.
Yeah. But it's like that one part you only remember. And then everybody's like, oh my gosh, I feel like I know that movie. And you can never find it until someone actually remembers other parts from it.
Carpenter did a lot of those movies. And the whole thing with him being a master director, I feel like that narrative started like 10, 15 years ago. It was after he quit directing movies. And all the cult stuff that he did just built to the point of where people don't have the point of reference as to whether it did well or not. And that doesn't matter anymore because it's older movies.
Yeah.
And then people are like, wow, because he was always ahead of the eight ball. Most of them, with the exception of maybe Halloween, were released just a little too early. Like if they had been a couple years later, they would have really blown up. Let's get into Carpenter for a minute because we covered The Thing in episode one, and I feel like we didn't get much time to talk about Carpenter because we had a guest who was a musician of some renown, and so we were in a rush through things, and we had so much on The Thing. We were just very, very focused on that.
Yeah.
And so John Carpenter was born in New York, and his father was a composer, which helps explain how he's so good with music, because John Carpenter does the score for most of his those movies. Not all of them, but most of them.
Yeah.
And part of that is necessity because he's always getting budgets that were not where he thought they should be. And so he would wear extra hats to cover that. You know, like he would write something because it's cheaper than finding a writer. And then he would direct it. And then he would do the music because it was cheaper than finding a composer.
Ooh, that's you pretty know, cool.
So he would do all of this stuff. And he was really good at it. He moved to Kentucky during the Jim Crow time. So he's like in the Bible Belt. They were very much outsiders, which it explains a lot of his movies because it's often your protagonist is somebody outside of everything.
Exactly.
Right? When he was growing up, he had a bunch of teenage friends that he felt very disconnected from them, especially when it came to race. He was talking about how he would hang out with them after class and they would all have guns and they'd go to the black area of their town. And then they would like shoot houses at random and think it was hilarious. And he just like was not on board with this.
Ooh, that's scary.
But this is who he's hanging out with. He talked about how he had one girl in his class whose grandfather ran over a black man in the middle of the road and then just called the cops and said, yeah, I ran over this guy and you need to go pick him up. This is the environment he grew up in. And so he actually does think about race a lot. You think about some of his movies, in particular, I think of like The Thing or They Live. Keith David has a very prominent role in those movies, right? You cut up to this movie, the cast is largely Chinese.
Yes, very.
And not just Asian, like Chinese as he put it. Like he was very careful with his casting. He was talking with all the actors. He was being very careful because this movie had come out a year before that was filmed in San Francisco. It leaned on all these Asian stereotypes. It was a big Hollywood movie.
Gotcha.
And all of those stereotypes had been happening for a long time, but it was kind of a resurgence of that sort of movie.
Gotcha.
And I remember this as a kid, you would get kung fu movies that would play on TV constantly that were from China. They wouldn't even do subtitles. They would always do the dubbing
the voiceover. Oh, yeah.
And they were crazy because you had no context for what would happen and you would get all these mystical tropes with the kung fu stuff. But also the voice actors half the time were making up stuff as they were going. They weren't even reading from a script from some of these. So disjointed from what it actually was.
Kind of like improvising a little bit if you think about it.
Yeah, but it's really not okay because you're changing the intentions of stuff in the movie, right?
I guess that's true, yeah.
So like this is the time period in which Big Trouble in Little China drops. And John Carpenter is a big fan of kung fu movies ever since he was a kid. Like going back to early 60s, he was watching any movie he could, including kung fu movies. And so he had this love of, he also had a love of westerns and horror movies and science fiction movies.
So he was a jack of all trades.
Yeah. And they were all blended into this movie if you stop to think about it. But the reason I bring up this particular part of his background is because I want to ask you the question. And I should preface this, if you haven't listened to previous episode, neither of us are Asian American. No, I am white. You're all kinds of things.
I'm everything. You know?
But I'm pretty sure I've never heard
there might be some Asian in here. I don't know.
Nothing you can claim, right? So like, do you think this movie is racist?
I don't know. Because John Carpenter, he was white.
Yes.
Okay.
100%.
It's hard to say because culture probably wouldn't understand. And in this, I don't know. I mean, you had Kurt Russell, who was the only white guy, you know, Kim Cattrall. She's the only, you know, white female in there.
You get the journalist too. Who's not a very big part.
I was forgetting about her. I'm so sorry.
Well, I mean, she doesn't do much in the movie. She's just an exposition machine.
She got kidnapped.
Yeah.
And she was a little bit of comedy there. But I don't know. It's hard to tell because watching it, I'm like, I could see yes and no.
So I think you're speaking to the rub here, which is like, when you look at the cast of Big Trouble in Little China, all the Asian actors regularly show up to anniversaries of the movie as it's gotten more and more popular. Because this is a movie, like many of Carpenter's movies, that just grew over time. It was not a hit when it came out.
But,
you know, it is that cult classic. They talked about how he was discussing with them, would your character do this? Is this okay? Is this okay? Like he was constantly having that discussion.
Yeah.
He was also putting all these tropes into place, but then he was subverting them. For example, this entire movie is based off of the premise that Jack Burton is supposed to be the hero, but yes. he acts like a sidekick because he's all blustery like John Wayne. Yeah. In fact, I think he's literally doing a John Wayne impression
the whole throughout time. The movie. He's yeah. the comedy act.
He's delivering this stuff as if he's like the swaggering hero, but then he screws up everything.
I mean,
all but like maybe one scene of the movie. So it's like he gets knocked out during the fight, or he like totally misses something or does something.
Shooting the gun, and he's like, yeah, and just shoots the gun. Yeah, and everybody takes off to the war, and he gets knocked out.
And then this
out.
Giant like, fight like, happens without him because yeah. he's knocked out. Like,
but then like,
and the hero, the actual hero yeah. of it, is his sidekick.
Which you don't realize that, like, okay, I didn't realize that until watching this again, and then yesterday,
because you're
like,
watching it analytically, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're doing what I do now,
yeah.
which is like you're watching a movie knowing I'm going to talk about this and what it's mm-hmm. about and all this stuff. So you're watching it a deeper way. And when you watch it in a deeper way, it's unescapable.
It
like
really
they're playing with that, and they have all of these tropes, but they're subverting them over and over again. So a big one I'm going to mention is they have the kind of Fu Manchu thing going on here. So for okay. people not familiar with Fu Manchu, he was this character in these British novels mm-hmm. that came out right before World War I and continued to come out through the 40s. And Fu Manchu was this criminal mastermind, and he had the really long mustache
yeah,
that goes
okay.
down and the big hat and the super long yeah, nails and yeah. all of that. This was what Fu Manchu looked like. This was a centerpiece, like the biggest character in yellow peril fiction,
yeah.
like, which was typically you would have a group of Chinese people that were being oppressed and they couldn't stick up for themselves. And you would have a white savior come and like fight this big figure from China who was like just evil for the sake of being evil, but would yeah. have honor a lot of the time. It's yeah. like all of these tropes wrapped up into it. Fu Manchu was like the biggest figure in that, so much so that they start making movies with him in the 20s.
Yeah, because he does the...
He continues up until 2009, I believe, is the last time they had a Fu Manchu character appearance in a movie. And that was in Black Dynamite, which I love that
Wait,
movie.
Black Dynamite. What
it makes fun of exploitation films. It's got Michael Jai White.
Oh,
it's,
never mind.
It's so funny.
I was thinking of Kung Pao.
And I think in 2006, Grindhouse has it.
Okay.
In a commercial, they have Nicolas Cage playing Fu Manchu
Do
in a fake commercial.
Do you remember Lady with the White Hair? Do you remember that one?
No, I don't think I ever saw
oh,
that.
Oh, dude. That one was a good one. That's what kind of reminded me of when you were saying the Fu Manchu. I can't even say that word right.
Fu Manchu. Like, that's a style of mustache,
yeah.
and it's literally named
it goes,
after
like,
that
right
character.
Right down to here. Interesting. Yeah. I did not know that. The Lady with the White Hair, there was also a guy like that, but it was kind of cool for back in its day because it was more female protagonist. Hearing you say that, I'm like, yeah, it was up until then that all those movies were coming out, and they had that character in there with the beard. And it's funny hearing you say that. I'm like, man, I do remember some of those.
Fu Manchu is this racist character that still has grounds in movies. You know, we're only 14 years removed from his last appearance in a film. And that one was very tongue-in-cheek. But we see this stuff constantly throughout media. We're seeing it all the way through the 80s for sure mm-hmm. when this movie comes out. And Pan Lo, it's a send-off of Fu Manchu.
Oh.
But I feel like this movie is also making fun of those tropes, right? Like, you have the sex trade in there. It's super ridiculous, too. You know, like, everything in here, they're just like, well, it's supposed to be this way. And then they're making fun of it. And I think putting the Kurt Russell character in the movie as the white savior, and then he's never the white savior. Furthermore, usually you have somebody download all the information to the white character, and then they're able to like become the hero and rescue everybody.
Yeah.
At no point does he ever understand what's going on.
Ever.
And furthermore, he doesn't save anybody.
And let me just say this, y'all. He doesn't give a crap. And anything he can do is simple, like shooting something. He's like, eh, well, it didn't work, so we can try the next thing. It's like, no, these are actual like spirits and things you're dealing with. Like, you can't.
Right.
You can't just shoot him with a gun.
So I guess what I come to is, I'm not Asian, so I'm not the person to judge. If I'm to go from my perspective, I think it's trying to subvert all that stuff, but okay. I also don't think it's like anti-racist necessarily, if that makes I think the fact that they're bringing up these things.
Yeah.
Is it problematic? I don't know. I went looking online for Asian people that were upset about. And the only thing I could find was a newspaper article written that was largely reacting to the movie before Big Trouble in Little China. But they hadn't even seen the movie yet. It hadn't been released.
So they just went ahead and started saying things before they even
got
an idea.
And I did read a couple of comments from Chinese Americans that were like, I love this movie. But at the same time, that's not everybody. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I will say, if somebody feels like it's racist, feel free to reach out to us. Let us know what we got wrong. But I'm looking at this as a subversion of this kind of thing. I'm not afraid to call out stuff on the show either, even for movies I love. Like, I love Flash Gordon. It's so racist in its portrayal of like Ming the Merciless. Yeah, I mean, like, it's another Fu Manchu thing with Ming the Merciless.
I feel like even if the actors haven't really said much, I mean, we had the guy from, he was from...
The actors have said a lot. Like, the Asian actors.
Oh, were they
like
irritated
James,
or were they...
No, they loved it. Like, James Hong, who is a Hollywood legendary character actor, and you just know him. You just know the dude. Yeah. He did a voice in Kung Fu Panda. James Hong was also in Gremlins. Like, he's the one who gives Mogwai.
I just realized, yep.
Or not gives it. Pointedly does not give it, and then his grandson gives it to Boyd Axton and that, right? So, like, James Hong loves this movie, too, and he's the one that's playing the character and understood what they were lampooning.
Yeah.
And has always approached it from that way when he talks about it. I
Mr.
think it's
Eggs.
Yeah. And I think he's great in this movie. It's just like, this movie is fun. Like,
it is
to
a
me,
lot of fun.
It's
I can't stop smiling about it, to be real honest. This is a great movie.
Yeah.
A great, great movie.
It's also, I believe, the fourth teaming of Kurt Russell and John Carpenter. So when John Carpenter makes Halloween and it burns up the world, he had already booked directing a TV movie about Elvis. Because, like, he didn't think this movie was going to be super huge. He was hoping it would be a success, but he never imagined it would go to the heights it did. Mm-hmm. So he gets saddled with Kurt Russell, who at this point was coming off of Disney. By the way, a little trivia. Walt Disney's last words, somebody asked him what the future of Disney would be, and he said Kurt Russell right before he died.
Really?
Yeah, and Kurt Russell
Kurt
was...
Kurt Russell's part of Disney?
Yeah, he did all these TV shows for Disney back in, like, the 60s. Mm-hmm. He did some movie about a computer. I don't know. It was like super corny, but he did some Disney stuff. And so he breaks into this TV movie. He's playing Elvis, and like John Carpenter directs him. It's already casted. It's already ready to go for him. And him and Kurt Russell hit it off. So he takes a risk when he makes Escape from New York and casts Kurt Russell, who's playing against type, because Snake Plissken is not a family-friendly hero. Like, he's an anti-hero, right?
Gotcha.
That movie gets like four times his budget, does really well. And then they immediately turn around and do The Thing, which bombs. To Universal, this is a failure. Never mind that it opens against E.T. and Blade Runner. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, it's just like...
Two big, you know, popular movies.
Yeah, and Blade Runner also bombed because E.T. destroyed everything for like
so
the next
crazy.
8 months.
It's so crazy.
It's what people wanted to see in an alien movie. They wanted to see the friendly alien at that point.
Yeah,
they
didn't
did
want
not...
to see people's faces splitting open and
yeah, which I wanted to see it.
The Thing, both those came out and someone was like, hey, are we gonna go see E.T. or are we gonna go see The Thing? I'm like, we're gonna go see The Thing, you know?
Yeah. So Kurt Russell and John Carpenter are coming off of an L, and they go to make this movie. They're definitely friends at this point, and Kurt Russell is up and coming. He hasn't had a giant hit just yet, but he's had some moderate hits, you know, like Overboard, like some comedy things, some little action things.
Okay, yeah.
And so he comes into this movie, and basically John Carpenter is like, I want you to play this hero who's not really a hero. John Carpenter said many times, like, I think it was really courageous of Kurt Russell because, like, you're playing against type. This could really upset the audience.
Yeah.
And Kurt Russell just didn't care. He was all about it.
Yeah,
you know?
I like that.
Still loves this movie, you know?
Yeah, that's good.
They're really good friends. I mean, they went on to do Escape from L.A. again, which was another L, like, with the exception.
I never saw that one.
It's not good. It's
okay,
not
so good.
Good.
I won't be watching it.
Sure. Yeah. I'll cover a Carpenter movie anytime.
Oh, me too.
I think Escape from New York is great. I think Escape from L.A. is not great. It's an example of what happens when John Carpenter gets a giant budget, because I think he's more creative when he doesn't have money.
Yeah.
And things just like...
Because he has the budget, and now he's like, okay.
I think they unify better because he's doing all of these things.
Yeah, and
that
his
he doesn't
mind
want
could kind
do.
Of be like, okay, we have to do it this way, and this is just how it's going to be, you know?
Yeah, he's a very trusting director in that when he hands the keys to somebody, he trusts them to do it when
That's
he does
awesome.
It. So, for example, when he has a big budget for The Thing, he hands off the score to Marconi, and Marconi puts a score together that sounds like Carpenter so much that people always think it's a Carpenter score because he did so many of them, and it's not.
Yeah.
But but it perfectly encapsulates the type of score that Carpenter likes to do, you know?
Yeah.
He trusts his actors. And I think before Big Trouble in Little China, you get Jeff Bridges, who's nominated for an Oscar in Starman, which was also not a hit. It was like a sci-fi movie, but it's also more of a love story.
Okay.
So like Carpenter is like spreading his wings and trying things. Starman?
Gotcha. Starman. I don't think I've seen that one either.
I have it on Blu-ray. Like, I like it, but it's you know, it hasn't aged super well.
Is the Robin Williams, is that Bicentennial Man?
Yeah.
Okay.
Way later.
Yeah, okay.
Starman's like an 80s movie. That's
what I think it is. Like, Starman, I was like, is that what that is? But it's not.
Way less depressing than Bicentennial Man. Holy God, that movie's depressing.
Bicentennial Man is super, super sad. I'm like, yeah. Oh man, okay.
With the exception of Escape from L.A., everything that Carpenter and Kurt Russell put out in the box office becomes cult classics. Like, even Escape from New York, which is a hit, becomes a cult classic because it's become so much more known, you know, out on home video.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we're facing when we're looking at the circumstances around this movie.
I can see that. Was this budgeted, Big Trouble Little China?
It was a big budget movie for him. It was $25 million. It made less than $10
million. Really?
Yeah. Oh, man. It ran into a buzzsaw. So John Carpenter was often going work for hire on stuff.
Yeah.
And most of it never pans out because he always gets pissed off at something or says, like, I don't know my way into it. So he gets offered Top Gun.
Yeah.
He doesn't take Top Gun. Tony Scott takes Top Gun. Top Gun opens right up against this.
Interesting.
And of course, like, Top Gun just eats its lunch. Ferris Bueller's Day Off also debuts the same week as Big Trouble in Little China. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, like, destroys this movie. Maybe it was one of those movies that could have gotten word of mouth, especially back in those times.
Mm.
When movies didn't do well, they would usually hang out in theaters for, like, at least a month.
Just to see if anybody would show up?
Yeah, yeah. Because, like, oh, I've already seen the big thing. 2 weeks later, Aliens opens. The movie posters are featuring Jack Burton prominently and really show nothing that has anything to do with the movie. And they're saying, who is Jack Burton? And Kurt Russell thinks, like, the ad campaign was terrible. Carpenter notes that they only spent $3 million on advertising, which was not very much for a $10 million movie. You want to spend about what the budget of the movie is.
Yeah, you want to throw out there, like, I mean, we've talked about trailers and stuff like that. You want to throw it out there that there's just enough, but you're not giving too much away. Throw the boring parts out there, you know?
Yeah. So this is a movie that just slow rolls on video and just gains more and more of a popularity.
Yeah.
I think when I was in high school, it was very much a culty thing. Like, there was some people had seen it and loved it. By the time I'm college age, there's a few more people. And then by my 30s, it becomes a legit cult classic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's all these people who are like, oh, Carpenter did this movie and this movie. Like, they're putting it together, realizing I should check out more of these movies. It's become a bigger artifact now than it was.
I agree. It's funny. Like, when my friend, during COVID, we watched this. It was a bunch of us. We were stuck in the house. This was during the shutdown. As we're scrolling through, I see Big Trouble Little China on Prime, and I'm like, oh my God. And my friend looks at me and goes, is that Big Trouble Little China? And all our other friends are like, what are you guys getting excited about? And him and I are like this on the couch, like, oh my God.
Bouncing up
and
down.
Oh my God. Yeah, he goes, oh my God, you know what this is? And we're like shaking each other. And finally, they're like, what is this movie? And there's like 10 of us in this house, you know? And two of us out of the 8 people are like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And he's like, quoted a part from there. And I was like, dude, shut up. I think it was the part where he's like, in the check, because it's my mom's favorite part. And he goes, the check is in the mail. Oh my gosh, hearing this movie and like hearing you say you want to watch this and hearing how it wasn't that big of a deal back then and it was coming out with
that's
all these
the thing about Carpenter, dude. That's his legacy. It's
so
just
crazy.
Like, he has these genre defying movies that just keep being influential and keep just blowing up after they come out.
I don't get excited
like,
about
John
a movie
Carpenter
like this,
is not
you know?
Known as a master of suspense until I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, you know what I mean? Like, well,
and then everybody got into it and they're like, even watching like how old school it was, you know, the background fighters, they're like, hiya, hiya. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like for real old school kung fu. They're doing all that. Cause some of the movies you don't hear that now, you know, now they're just kind of, they fly around and do
And Carpenter was, they were flying around in those movies too, doing wire work and stuff. Like Carpenter was grabbing it from authentic kung fu movies.
Exactly.
You know? He was showing things on the screen that he had already seen in movies and was like doing it his way.
This movie's good. Like, I just don't get excited. Like, like here telling you that my friend and I, like, it was so nice to like watch our friends, and our friends actually were like, we were curious at first and now we love this movie. And I was like, I told you.
It just takes one watch.
Exactly.
Like, it really just takes one watch and you become part of a cult. That's it. Like, it's one of those movies. So let's get into the synopsis. All right. A lawyer grills Egg Shen about why a whole city block was destroyed. He infers that Jack Burton may have been at fault. Egg Shen snaps at him that Burton is a hero and to leave him alone. The lawyer examines Shen's story and asks if he expects him to believe in wizards, magic, and monsters. Egg Shen confirms that yes, he should, because they're real. This opening scene, you could carve from the movie and it would be totally fine. Yep. And the reason for that is because the executives didn't know what they were watching, and they were like, you have to place Jack Burton as a hero, you need to give a primer to the audience to what they're going to see. And Carpenter rolls his eyes and then just has him explain it to a lawyer, which is how he looked at the suits, is like these lawyers that were in these positions. Because in the 80s, you're getting all of the big movie companies are like bought out by, like, for example, Coca-Cola. And they're treating movies like a product, not like a piece of art. So like, there's this formula. You need to go to this formula. So Carpenter's just like, ugh, whatever. Yeah. So he puts in the scene. So that scene, you can throw it away. Way, if you want to like cut the runtime on the movie a little bit, just carve out that part, because it doesn't matter. And it's inaccurate because Jack Burton is not a hero.
No, he's not. He's not. Look, I'm all mad. I'm like, he's not the hero, but he is.
No, he's not. He's not, though. He's positioned like it, but he's not.
I think he's the sidekick.
He's the sidekick. He just doesn't know he's the sidekick.
Yeah.
Jack Burton wins a poker game. His friend Wang Chi bets him double or nothing that he can cut a beer bottle in half. Burton takes the bet and Wang fails. He says he'll get his money after they pick up his fiance Miao Yin at the airport. Burton insists on driving him to make sure he gets paid. When they get to the airport, a gang called the Lords of Death try to kidnap a girl who is being met by Gracie Law, a white woman who lives in the neighborhood. Jack gets in their way, so they kidnap Miao Yin instead. So this movie immediately sets up that he's going to be the protagonist, right? Because he's at the poker game, he's talking a lot of crap, he's winning. And then the guy is like going like, oh, I'll get your money. Just, I have to do this thing first. This is what you would see a sidekick doing.
Exactly.
This is how they're setting up the audience to like not realize what they're about to see.
And it's so hard because they don't focus on Wang too much, but they do.
After this, you see him as much as Jack Burton. You know what I mean? And he's kicking butt and Jack Burton is fighter. Not.
Yeah.
And even the thing with him going to cut the bottle in half, this is in a way his hero's journey. And what I mean by that is like, he's unfocused because he's got this woman he's in love with that he's gonna marry. You don't realize he has all of this skill and could totally do this thing.
Yeah.
You know, and but so, like, obviously he gets his concentration and is like way better as he needs to save this woman.
Exactly.
So we don't see that it's actually him that has this arc, because Jack Burton really has no arc. He's just the guy who blows into town, doesn't understand anything that's going on.
He's some truck driver. He's just some friend.
He's just a truck driver.
I think the only, and if you like, once we get into it, the only reason he's even there is to get money, if you think about it.
Yeah, it's not even a lot of money. It's not $1,148.
And then I think later on he goes, now it's times two, but we'll get.
Well, no, because he's an idiot. And he says, as long as they can double 1,148 and divide it by two. And it's like, dude, it's literally the number you just said.
What you're asking for. But yeah, he's literally there to get a bet. I don't even think, he was not supposed to be there. And then he runs into Gracie and it just becomes, it's a whole thing.
And Gracie is supposed to be there because she's one of the couple of walking exposition dumps, right? Like, she knows what's going
on.
She's
helping out with whatever's going on.
Which, by the way, is a thing that you would see in these movies subverted, because in a lot of these kung fu movies that are Americanized, you would have a Chinese person that's like telling you all of the information.
Yeah.
Who knows all this information, but they're telling it to the white character. But instead they have a white character like who knows what's going on, telling it to him.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? Like, so they're subverting that trope too. Like, this movie, even though it's like goofy and you can talk about things that are kind of dumb in it and laugh about it, it's really smart.
They did some smart things where you're like, interesting. I didn't know that. that was good. And really things that were going on as well.
And even Jack Burton goes to save that woman for being taken by the gang at the airport, and it's the wrong woman. So they wind up taking the fiance, which is exactly what he is trying to avoid. So that's like the first time you really see Jack Burton screw up.
Oh my gosh. You're just like, okay, so she's gone.
Jack and Wayne track the Lords of Death from the airport to an alley. There's a funeral procession that turns into, as Wang Chi puts it, a Chinese standoff. The ally is blocked on one side with warriors called the Chang Sing. The other side is blocked by Wing Kong. They begin to fight, and Jack tries to drive the truck out anyway. Warriors named Thunder, Rain, and Lightning appear and use storm powers to annihilate the Chang Sing side. Lo Pan blocks the truck from leaving, and Jack runs over him, only to discover that he's behind the truck. Lo Pan glows and blinds Jack. Wing helps Jack escape. They double back to find his truck is gone. I love the whole scene in the alley, dude. It's so ridiculous because you see Kim Cattrall is just like telling Jack about the gang and like, oh, don't mess with them. And I think that's all she does. But every time they do an exposition thing, it gets lengthier.
Yeah.
And it gets harder to follow.
It keeps going. It keeps going. Yeah.
And so he's saying like, oh no, it's this funeral procession. It's these two gangs. Like, just stay quiet. Don't get involved. So we're already starting to get longer in the exposition because Jack has no idea what's going on. I think at one point he says, I'm feeling like the outsider here. And they're like, you are.
But I love that you are. And then I love that he's getting ready to battle. And it's like, no, dude, stay in the car. What are you going to do? Help these two gangs? And then like the gang starts
fighting. Know which side is good when you're watching it the first time.
He's just kind of like, he just like pulls his knife out and he's like, shink. And you're just like, what are you going to do? And Wang's just kind of looking at him like, just sit in the car and be quiet. And like, as you should. I love that Rain, Thunder, and Lightning, right?
Yeah. Yep.
They all like
who have rain powers, thunder powers, and lightning powers.
I'm going to tell you all right now, you don't expect that from this movie. And then these guys just show up like out of nowhere.
Yeah. It should be mentioned Lightning. He is the basis for that Mortal Kombat character, Raiden. Like, that's not actually like a Chinese thing. Like, whenever they showed the elemental characters like that, they're usually animals in Chinese films. So it's like, this is one way in which this movie's influential. It's like, this giant fighting game.
Rain's face when they like pan on it. I try not to laugh at some things. I'm like, oh man, I bet right there. They're like, okay, get his face quick. We need you to just look crazy. But the war scene, they just start fighting. You think it's a funeral. All of a sudden they just start shooting guns and, Kung Fu starts coming out of nowhere. Dude,
I love when Lo Pan is glowing and they had like replaced his head with this fake head that lights up, and it's so cool. Oh, it looks so awesome when he like lights up and blinds Jack.
I do like when they hit him with the truck, because that was old school, because it's just like a dummy, and the way they hit him and then he's just standing there and turns back around. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Yeah. And he even says like, you didn't hit him. It was an illusion.
It was an illusion. Yeah. But
he's a ghost, right? That's what we discovered down the line. Lopan, I know it's hard to follow, but like Lopan's a ghost. He is a ghost, right?
But he's like,
by the way, this is something we should say about this movie really quick. So we were talking about it yesterday and I was laughing because I was like, the plot doesn't really matter to the movie. It's there if you want to follow it, but like, it's not meant to be followed. It's just
more entertainment.
It's just exposition and to have the comedy of the exposition. You and our boss stared at each other and you guys were like, I don't even know what the movie's about. Like, I can't remember it. And he was like, I can't remember either. I'm like, because it doesn't matter.
We did.
We're breaking it down because we're doing this podcast, but like, it truly doesn't matter.
And then, I forgot. Yeah. Him and I just looked at each other and we're like, because you were like, well, do you guys even know what it was about? And we're like, I know. No.
Yeah. And I didn't either, by the way. I had to like take copious notes while I'm watching this.
I knew there was something with him trying to fulfill something. I knew it was something of that nature. Yep. I didn't know was what we were going to get into. But that's so funny that you say that. You're like, you and our boss, I'm like, we just looked at each other like.
There's there's two movies in particular I can think of. And one is going to be covered on this feed a little bit later, which is The Big Lebowski. In this one, they have this super complicated plot going on, but it's background and you don't need to pay attention to it to actually know what's going on in this movie. It's what makes it fun. Wang brings Jack back to his restaurant. Gracie appears with a journalist named Margot, Eddie Lee, and Ed Egg Shen, who is a wizard. They believe that the Lords of Death sold Mio Yin to a brothel. Jack goes undercover while the group waits outside. The Wing Kong break in and kidnap Mio Yin because she has green eyes, a rarity for the Chinese. So you get like Jack Burton is like wearing just this god awful like 70s style suit.
Yeah,
this
just like checkered.
He's got the big thick frame glasses
belt
and
buckle.
Stuff.
Oh god! And is that a mullet I saw?
Oh dude, yeah, it was the 80s.
It wasn't
yeah.
bad though. It wasn't a bad mullet. I can't
okay.
be mad at it.
I know that the for younger people, I know that the mullet you think of the South now when you think of the mullet, or at least yeah. like people who are kind of roughneck or whatever. But in the 80s, there was a period of time where it was
the
like
mullet was cool.
It was in there was. And you can see Kurt Russell in a couple of these films sporting the mullet.
Honestly, I will say one thing. My mom being half white, half black, and we were cultured. We always knew like mullets to us wasn't just, you know, trashy or whatever. It was, that was a style. You
it
know?
Became trashy.
It became like, trashy.
It, it was not trashy at first.
Yeah, because it's, and it's, if you look at it throughout
the
movies.
Even the 70s, it was like the popular
it
look
seemed like
through
it.
A lot
yeah.
of the 70s.
Feathered
yeah.
look, you know, all of those. Nowadays, you look at it, now it's like, it's coming off trashy. And really, I was cultured. You
By
know,
the way,
so.
All of our hairdos are going to look terrible in like 20 years.
Oh, definitely.
Like all
it's
of them.
It's just going to be whatever you want it to be.
Yeah, it's this stuff changes in a secular.
I'm glad I'm bald.
I think the half-shaved head, I've identified that in 20 years is going to look super ridiculous. And then in like 30 or 40 years, it'll be back. Like this is just how this stuff goes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mullets are coming back. I see it.
Jack and Wayne go to the Wing Kong Exchange. They find a secret elevator that goes down. It starts filling with salt water and they nearly drown as they escape to the next room, which is also filled with water. Thunder is in a grate above and beats them down. He brings them to Lopan, who now appears as an old man in a wheelchair. Lots of comedy in this where every time they go to an elevator or a lift or whatever, it's always like, do I go up or down?
Like, yeah, and like, and if we do, where are we going to wind up at? You know?
Something else that's interesting. John Carpenter, to this day, big video game fan. He's infamous now for talking about interviews and he just wants to play video games all the time.
Yeah, it explains a lot in this movie.
Yeah, and this movie is set up like a video game in a lot of parts. And you got to keep in mind, it's like 80s video games at this point. But one of the things you would always see in those old Nintendo games, before you get to the boss, you're often like on an elevator or something so you can take your time before you go to the next level.
I never caught that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome.
And you see it way later, and I don't think I took note of it in the synopsis, but there's a part where Egg Shen and Lopan are fighting with these spirits. Mm-hmm. And they have like lights coming out of their hands and then they're moving their thumbs as if they're doing a controller. So they're playing a video game against each other. And it doesn't matter because like Eggman dies and he's like, you could never beat me at this.
Even when we were younger. And I was like, oh my gosh, this was, God, love it. I did not know.
Carpenter's developed a couple of video games. Nothing that's ever come out, but it is a passion of his. And that's kind of where he's been, is every time somebody's like, why don't you make another movie? And he's so disgusted with Hollywood because of the history we've been talking about.
Whoa.
Bad timing for movies, studios undercutting his budgets, like on and on and on. He always says, like, I just want to sit there and play video games and then extend out my hand and get that occasional Halloween check, right?
Yeah, there you go. That's awesome. I did not pick up on that. You just opened my mind to a whole new world.
Yeah, and then, of course, Lopan in the wheelchair. So I think what they're trying to show is that he has no flesh, which doesn't read as much in HD.
Is the So besides Jack Burton, Lopan is probably one of my most favorite comedy. Like he cracks me up throughout the whole movie.
Me too. And that's what I'm talking about. Is also like Fu Manchu is essentially what he's doing.
Yeah.
And they're making fun of it, but also like super problematic character. Yeah. So it's like they're trying to take the piss out of that. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly.
Wing explains that he was defeated in battle by Emperor Huang. He cursed Lo Pan with becoming a living ghost. If Wang can marry a green-eyed girl and then sacrifice her to the Emperor, the curse will be lifted and he will rule the world from the afterlife. The rest of the group breaks in to rescue Jack, Wing Kong, and Miao Yin, but they are captured as well. So this has my favorite scene, which is they're all rushing to get out, and Jack Burton is in the lead, and they're right by this door. And he's like, all right, everybody back, and then when I open it, we'll go running through, like, basically straight to the exit, right?
Yeah.
And he opens the door and then just sees, like, all of these people out and closes it really quick, and he's like, we might be trapped.
We might be trapped. They get cut into the door. And it's like so funny. I don't know why I made the noise, but that's the noise because it keeps going when he's cutting down the door. And it just, I'm like, okay, the noise, the sound effects is awesome. And then like the flips, they break into the door and out of nowhere, Wang just does this flip and he just lands and starts whooping booty. And you're just like, what the heck? All right. I guess he knows what he's doing.
Jack manages to free himself and Wing Kong. Thunder goes into their cell to investigate, and Jack gets a drop on him with a knife from his boot with the second try, right? Because he comes up behind him with the knife, and then the dude, like, gets a knife out of his hand, knocks him to the floor.
Yeah.
And then his partner goes to fight him, and then, like, and then Jack gets the knife again, and then,
tries,
like,
to get him.
Yeah, does it again.
And blows him back.
Very much a sidekick move. Oh, I love that. It just makes me laugh so much. They free some women that are in cells, but not Meow. A monster that looks like an orangutan grabs Gracie before she can get out. Lopan notices that Gracie has green eyes. He decides to sacrifice her after marrying Meow Yen. One thing that always makes me laugh is that old trope of the painting with the eyes,
yes,
that are peeking through to let you know the danger, right?
Yeah.
And it's like almost cross-eyed when you see it. And then that goofy looking monster comes out. Now, that was an accident with the cross eyes. They could not get the mechanical eyes to do what they were supposed to do. Dude, they're just supposed to track to the left and right.
It was
and
instead perfect, they went cross eyes.
But it makes it so much funnier.
Monster, yeah, because then you see the monster. I love when it grabs her. It's just it's like this hand, and it like grabs her, and she's like,
An orangutan is not the proper way to describe this, but I don't know how else to say it.
It looks just like an okay. So think of an orangutan with this like elongated snout, or like its mouth opens all the way. Like it's basically an orangutan with a.
It's huge like a
mouth.
Demonic orangutan, kind of.
I think you hit it right because I could. I used to ask my mom, I'm like, "What is that thing?" She goes, "I don't know."
Yeah, you're not supposed to know.
I don't know, and I love also that he's like, "Well, she's not Asian, but she has green eyes. My luck." And I'm like, "So does she not have to be Asian?"
Yeah, it's really
like. So is it anybody with green eyes? Because at this point, you could have just had half the world, really, if you wanted.
The group returns to Chang Sing and Egg Shen. They enter a cavern that connects up to Wing Kong Exchange. A monster tries to attack them from a wall, and Egg Shen throws powder at it, saying it won't return.
I love
that, dude, because that's another thing where it's just like, he just hurls his powder and it like flashes. And then, you know, he tells Jack it won't be back. And then Jack is like, what is going
Jack's
on?
Jack's like, what? Okay, first of all, you're telling me there's things breathing in the water. Now there's this monster that just came. And he's like, come on, let's just go. I love that everything is normal to them, but to Jack, those are normal reactions. Yeah. To me, to you, we would react that way. To them, they don't react that way because they've been through it. But to me, I'm like, that is my reaction. What is that thing? Why? Oh, it can't just come out because you're magic powder.
Yeah. And once again, they're subverting that white savior trope because this is the point in the movie where he should be overtaking everything and leading the group, but he's not. He's still befuddled by what's
still
going
the
on.
Sidekick.
He keeps running into like right before them. They have everybody is just rushing through exposition and it's gotten so long now where they're doing like reams and reams and reams of information. And he's just like his eyes are just wide and he's looking around like, what are we talking about?
Yeah, I just,
all he wants is his money.
He wants his money. And at
once
this
again,
point, does he want answers?
Once again, he's risking his life for a little over $1,100.
Exactly. And now it's so crazy. Yeah. Oh my gosh. That part where he's like, what's happening? What is exactly going on? Just keep coming along with us.
A beholder sees the group and tips off Lopan. Jack tries to shoot it, saying you'll never know until you try. I love that too. So
yep.
A beholder is like a D&D thing. I don't know if they named it a beholder or if that was a thing that existed before D&D, but it's the thing with all the eye stalks and it's got all the eyes everywhere.
Yeah.
Just a little puppet thing. Such a fun 80s thing.
Later.
Yeah. And when he goes to shoot it, it just scurries off really quickly.
Yeah. And then he says the comment like, well, at least we had a try. Let's keep moving.
Never know unless you try.
It's the Jack Burton way, everybody. Like, and he says that the Jack Burton way is literally just try whatever. So he just shoots the thing and it's like, okay, it didn't work. Keep moving.
Egg Shen gives them a potion that will aid them before they get on the elevator, which, like, as far as I can tell, all that happens is they get stoned because they're on the elevator and he's just like, I feel really good.
Don't they start glowing?
I don't remember that.
So I feel like in the remastered, they never showed it like this one we watched. In the old one, I'm pretty sure they glowed. I think they get brighter.
It's possible, or it could just be your tracking was messed up on your VCR.
Oh, no. that could be
just,
what it was.
I'm just kidding. They go up and sneak in on the wedding. They wait until Lo Pan marries Miao Yin so that he is corporal and can be killed. Then Jack fires a couple rounds into the ceiling to signal an attack. This dislodges concrete that knocks him out. Chang Sing and Wing Kong battle. Wang and Rain have a sword fight as they leap dozens of feet into the air. And I was watching this and I was just like, they so took this scene and just like elevated it in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Yes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Wang comes out on top. Lo Pan has his flesh again and flees. Jack and Gracie kiss in an elevator and exit to face Lo Pan. Jack hurls his knife at him, missing badly. Lo Pan picks it up and comments it's a great knife. He then flings it at Jack, who catches it and returns it into Lo Pan's forehead. So he finally gets his hero moment. I would say much as the sidekick does towards the end of a movie, right? Often the sidekick will be the one who somehow comes through, because their arc is usually like, I can't do anything right. And then suddenly they do something
we got that throughout the movie.
I do kind of wish that he wasn't the one that killed him, because it's so funny watching him fail throughout the entire movie. I would love it if they just continued it.
Which
that.
I think the fail was the first knife throw. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. He misses him by like 4 feet.
Oh my God. He missed him way 100%.
And he doesn't have a gun. Like, yeah, I just got this knife. And like Gracie's looking at him like, oh no.
She's like, great. So we're all going to die.
She also, when she kisses him, she leaves lipstick on him and he just
so
has
it.
And then
it even better.
Before he goes to fight Lo Pan, she like sees it and then like wipes it off of him.
Oh, hold on. Lo Pan, the whole point of it is to him to get a human body. Like, that was the whole point of the movie.
To get a human body and then
to get
and
flesh.
Then sacrifice the bride so that he can die.
Yeah.
And then he rules the earth from the afterlife.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
It's so weird. His laugh, though, I had to rewind that 3 times, because as he's like becoming human and the blood's coming out and he does that laugh. Dude, that was the most, like, that was a laugh that I was like, I wonder how he did that. Because I just kept rewinding him, like, that laugh is so awesome, because he was just so excited. He's like, I'm becoming human. Like, like, oh my God. Greatest laugh ever.
Thunder reappears and finds out that Lo Pan has died. He begins swelling up like a balloon and explodes. And you see like the guts coming out of the doorway, because he swells up earlier in the movie, which we didn't cover. And they don't really do anything with it. But then when he finds out that Lo Pan's dead, he keeps swelling and swelling. And like, you'll see this on YouTube clips. They always do it for like most outrageous deaths and things like that.
And face and his nostrils flare up.
Yeah, and there's like smoke coming out of
it. Looks like a hippo, like an oversized hippo.
And then Wang is like, I don't think he's going to stop. And so they run out of the room.
I love when him and Wang are fighting and it's just Wang doing flips. Thunder doing hands. And what you're supposed to be seeing is Thunder's creating a whirlwind, but really it's just like people throwing things out.
Yeah.
And I was like, I would love to have been that person. Like, I want to be the person that throws this huge dresser. throws a dresser. Just things are flying, you know? It's so great.
Lightning corners the group in a tunnel, but they manage to escape through a hole to the surface. Thunder is killed by Egg Shen dropping a Buddha statue on him. The group finds Jack's truck and drive back to Wang's restaurant. I also love that with Lightning, where he's just like destroying
the
tunnel around him. But then he has to die by a Buddha statue dropping, which is like supposed to be for like meditation and like being in the moment and things like that. It's like, no, we're gonna use this to kill you.
Just throw it down on him in this hole. And so they like throw it down on him, and that's the end of Lightning.
Yeah. Wang and Miao Yin prepare to marry. Margo hooks up with Eddie. Egg Shen decides to take a vacation. Gracie wants to come with Jack on his next haul, but he refuses. He drives off bragging into his CB about how he bravely faces storms as the orangutan creature pops its head up in the truck. This is another thing John Carpenter talked about with Kurt Russell, which was that people always expect him to do sequels out of his movies because he'll have something like that. And he's like, no, that's the movie. It's just like, this is the way it ends. Because it's an ending that captures your imagination.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, let's just let the orangutan monster, it never even did anything to Jack. Let's just say it jumped off there and who knows what happened to it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think part of it is that like Jack is not going to be able to handle it.
No.
He doesn't have his friends around him.
Yeah, at all. Good luck to you, Jack. Yeah. Oh, geez.
I love this movie. Me too. So much fun.
And as you guys could tell, the podcast, this one is just, we're all over the place because there really is a plot to it, but there's not a plot to it. It's just...
There's a plot that doesn't matter. You know?
Exactly.
This was also supposed to be a Western when it was first written.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah. And John Carpenter looked at it and was like, I'm interested in the script, but he thought it was horribly written. So he brought in another screenwriter, and then it went through arbitration, like arguing over credit. And so the guy who changed it adapted it, but he changed it a lot because it was a Western. And then John Carpenter was like, let's turn this into a Kung Fu movie with the same idea.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because the kernel of the idea was this guy goes into town who's basically a cowboy, and it's like a period piece. So it would have been more expensive, right? You're talking like the
Alamo kind of
1860s, I think. And so you have this guy come in, but he acts as a sidekick. Like that was the kernel of the idea that they turned into this movie that apparently was completely different other than the premise.
What I really did enjoy about this movie is it is entertaining. There's constantly something going on. You're not bored.
You never feel peril in this movie, but I think that's just fine because it's like most action movies. Like, I guess that was a criticism of this when it came out, as people felt like, you know, I'm never worried the characters are going to die, but that's how you always feel in action movies. Like, you watch it and you're like, they're going to get through everything. Like, you know, that's why superhero movies kind of take action movies lunches in a way, is because it's the same thing. You see the superhero go out there and you're like, they're invulnerable. They're not going to get hurt. It's not a big jump from, like, say, Bruce Willis in Die Hard, who never gets hurt and, like, just keeps going through the things, to then just, all right, we'll give them powers so it makes more sense why they never get hurt. You know what I mean?
Right.
But this movie is literally, the villains have powers, some of them.
Yeah.
But you're never worried for a second Jack Burton's gonna get hurt. You're never worried Gracie's gonna get hurt.
Yeah, Wang, none of them. You just know they're getting kidnapped, or
which makes it a really fun, breezy watch because you just watch it and
none of the main characters will die per se, you know, as far as like heroes go. But as far as villains go, and like I said, Lopan, that was a hilarious.
Yeah, dude, James Hong is like on a heat check.
Dude, he's
for the
great.
Whole movie. He's
did
so
he
good.
Play in the
he did
wheelchair?
Every version of him, yeah.
Oh my gosh, by the way.
So he's
wheelchair.
The ghost that looks like Fu Manchu. Yeah. And then he's also in the wheelchair.
I love when Gracie tries to bite him. And like, I've had enough to hear with you. And he's like, oh.
That's like another thing too, is John Carpenter was a big Howard Hawks fan. So like, he redid The Thing from Another World and makes The Thing, you know, which is like a Howard Hawks movie. But then also this movie, when you're looking at Gracie and the journalists, like, they're very fast talking and very much like they're out of a Howard Hawks movie. And that's something else that makes me laugh, is like, they have the energy from like a 50s, gosh, mister, and then like telling them all the things super fast. Like, they have that energy. Jack Burton is basically John Wayne, who has the opposite energy of like slowly delivering his stuff and like having swagger. And then Wang has an entirely different energy. You know what I mean? Like, all these people are like, they come together, and it's so funny the way in which they mix and interact.
Yeah. I was going to say, do you feel like they could do another movie like this together and not it be Big Trouble Little China? But
let's talk about that really quick, because I feel like, can you get the energy of this sort of thing? If it was that easy, there would be more versions of this. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it's that easy. I think Carpenter can do it. I don't know about other people.
Is John Carpenter still doing movies?
No. His last movie, I think, was in 2009. He's very much like upset with Hollywood. I think he just did a true crime show that he directed literally from his house.
He's
just
really
like had the monitors like wired up in his house and did it. And he's been teasing that maybe someday he'll do a sequel to The Thing. The word has been, if they can get Wyatt Russell in, that's the key to getting Kurt Russell and John Carpenter in.
Well,
because
he did such a
friends.
Good in The Thing, the first one. Well, and what did you think about the newer, because they did a newer one. I actually didn't.
Big Trouble in Little China?
No, The Thing.
Oh, I think it's fine, but I think the whole thing trades off of making the audience understand what The Thing is, because they have the whole thing where it's like, oh, if it has inorganic material left on it, then it's The Thing because it can't process this stuff. And I'm always like, No, dude, you just gave a tell. Like, right away, they just misunderstood what that movie was. Period. I think they had good intention of, like, hooking it up to the Carpenter movie. I just think it falls short. You can't take a classic and stand up to it, you know?
Look at all these movies we're doing now that I'm like, okay, guys, let's come up. I think we talked about it on a podcast. I think it was Rosemary's Baby, but I'm like, I wouldn't really want them to redo Rosemary's Baby, per se.
Which they already did. In a multitude of ways, yeah.
And that's where I get with, I think I've asked him, like, if they revamped Big Trouble Little China, first off,
I'm not into it.
Me either. Yeah. I don't want a part two. I don't want it to carry on. I don't want them to redo things. I don't want it to even be, now don't get me wrong, Jurassic Park did really good at intertwining everything together, but they also
did really bad as it continued to.
And then
like Jurassic World was fun, and then it had two sequels that were not so fun.
Yeah, I actually didn't mind them, but I see what you mean. And it's like, okay, we're there, but to keep doing more and more movies, that's why I was like, if we revamp Big Trouble Little China, let me tell you something, you better make that best damn revamp you can. But I don't see it coming into fruition.
No. So famously The Rock was trying to make it as a sequel, and I think he was gonna play Jack Burton, and then John Carpenter came out and said that he wasn't into it, and then they got him on board as a producer by saying that instead it was going to be a sequel where Dwayne The Rock Johnson was playing a different role, and then Kurt Russell was going to reprise his role, which I think is how they got Carpenter into it. But that was 2015 that they made that announcement. So I don't think it's happening, because 8 years is a long time.
It really
time.
Is. Well, I mean,
Russell does not look like he can do the action thing anymore.
Not like that. And if you think about it, I mean, the last movie I really saw him in that he did action was Bulletproof. And that was...
He's in Bulletproof?
Or not Bulletproof. I'm sorry. What's the one with... Not Bulletproof.
Backdraft?
No.
92?
No. It was the one where he... Death Proof. I'm sorry. Death Proof.
Oh.
That was the last kind of... Like,
but he's doing everything from a car.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
That was like, kind of something I saw
That was in Grindhouse, which has the Fu Manchu thing with Nick Cage in one of the fake trailers. There you go. It connects. It all connects.
All right. You got me there. No, and that's where... If, like I said, I really hope they don't. And the thing is I don't want to see The Rock play. No, I'm so I'm already mad. I'm like, no, he can't do it. Like
when they were talking about having The Rock play Jack Burton, that's a horrible idea, because The Rock famously won't lose a fight, just like Vin Diesel.
Exactly.
Like, they go into movies and they won't lose a fight. So right away, you can't play Jack Burton because you're not doing what Jack Burton's supposed to do.
I want to see
the whole point
Paul
of that
Rudd.
Is that Jack Burton can't win a fight.
No, yeah. Like, if anything, I hate saying it like this. I want to see like Paul Rudd do Kurt Russell, do Jack Burton.
He would do better at that than The Rock.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Paul Rudd, anybody that's...
But I also don't think he cuts the action. You know who could actually do it, honestly?
Who?
To be clear, once again, don't want to see a remake of
Me
this.
Either.
Don't
We're
want to see a sequel or anything,
yeah.
Unless Carpenter decides to do it. But what I actually want to see, Michael Jai White from Black Dynamite in this role, because that dude can do the action thing, and he's really funny.
Okay.
And I think he would understand, like, no, I'm supposed to look like the action the action guy, but like not deliver on anything. I think Michael Jai White actually could kill that, because he checks both boxes, if that makes sense.
And Wang, what's funny is you could actually redo this movie and not, I mean, hear me out. You don't have to make it predominantly Asian. You could really revamp it into something different and do the same concept if John Carpenter were to do that. And then it would be kind of cool to see what actors they could get. So revamping it, but making it a whole new movie.
I just don't think anybody should do it.
I really don't think they should. But
I hear what you're saying.
Now I'm throwing some names out there, and I'm like, well, maybe.
Another piece of trivia I find kind of fascinating. So at this point, Jackie Chan had not broken out into American movies, but he was considering playing the sidekick in this. The sidekick who's the hero, right? But he wound up bombing in his previous two movies in Hong Kong, and so he kind of doubled down to make sure that he would start delivering hits again. So I think his next one was Police Story, which was one of his most successful movies in Hong Kong cinema.
I feel like I remember Police Story. Well, and if you think about it, he did make that right decision.
He did, because he solidified his base before he went on. And then I think, trying to remember what the first one in America was, I think it was Rumble in the Bronx. And like, that was a huge hit for like what it costed. And it was definitely one of those things where it was like people took note of him. I think it was like Rumble in the Bronx and then Super Cop, if I remember. Rumble in
the
Bronx?
Is that the one? I feel like, okay.
They're like in a convenience store and part of it. And like, I don't know. Like, they're all
in a parking garage too? Like a top story.
Dude, it's been so long.
I know this is crazy, but there's a part where I remember he had taken an antenna off of a car and he whoops a guy with it. Oh my God. And I could not remember what that movie was. And I thought it was Rumble in the Bronx.
I will say, as much as I love Jackie Chan, I'm really glad he didn't do this movie because I think the actor they got did a great job. But also, even though this movie is a comedy, I don't think the sidekick is that much comedy. Like, he's playing it serious and Jack Burton is a comedy. And like, Jackie Chan is a brilliant comedian. And I feel like he would have made it funnier from that part. But I think you kind of lose something by like screwing up that dynamic a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm glad Jackie Chan didn't get this particular role.
Because he would have to have a comedy part instead, which I get.
Yeah, because you want to play to the actor's strengths.
Yeah,
right?
Which I think Wang and the who was the other Asian guy that comes in and helps them? I forgot his name, but he's also the friend.
Egg Shen.
Not Egg Shen, but the guy in the suit, the suited guy.
Oh, Eddie.
Yeah, Eddie. Yeah. I love Eddie. They kind of made up their two parts together without Jack Burton was kind of comedy. You know what I mean? Because they...
And there are a lot of exposition
exactly,
as well,
right? Yeah. So, but I will say Wang was... That was a good actor. Like, I enjoyed him. I thought he had a little funny, but he was more of the serious role. And so I could take that, you know, where he would be like, Jack, like, dude, come on. Or even when they take Mao Yan and he's like, Jack, come on, we have to go after them. Like, he's not playing any games. Jack's just like, yeah, whatever, I'm going to do all that. And he's like, we're about business. Let's go. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He did have some good comedy there where it was like, okay, he's funny, but mostly funny towards Jack being Jack, you know?
Yeah, I'm such a sucker for the hero who, like, falls short as a hero.
Yeah.
Especially when they talk a lot of crap and they can't back it up.
Exactly.
You know? Like Bruce Campbell in Army of Darkness. Yes, he can fight Deadites, but he talks so much crap and he's such a dumb dummy. Of New York, number one original. Wake up! Culture of my dying on the job. And I kinda like to be the one to tell you. Girl, you be not to be. Oh yeah. A Cosmic Void was created by Alex Small and Jeremiah Perez. It's hosted by Alex Small and Xavi Cousins. Produced by Aaron Donaldson and Alex Small. The theme song Duke of New York A No. 1 was written by Dub Campbell and Greg Vivrette. The song is performed by Tonight We Ride. A Cosmic Void is a Redwood Sound Labs production.
Okay, kiddo, I lost my library of sound, so I need you to do some sound effects for me.
I don't want to do this, Dad.
Look, I'm just trying to put food on the table, but if you don't want to help...
All right.
Hear Biggs chronicle a galaxy of genre. Listen to the deconstruction of film on A Cosmic Void. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient and cinematographer. Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together, they explore the narrative, effective, and production politics of war cinema on Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project. Finally, a podcast that's dedicated to talking about your favorite sports movies. Whether you want to hear a breakdown of the plot, arguments about who's the MVP of the film, or crit and lit about it, you'll find it all on Fields of Glory. Listen to the show that will help you have a better life with your beloved pets. It handles topics like proper food, nutrition, positive reinforcement training, and more. Certified dog behavior consultant Charlotte Peltz welcomes your pet concerns and questions in the podcast, Living with Your Dog. Zach and Matt are two horror enthusiasts of varying experience discussing horror movies through the scope of content, context, and comedy. They'll hit on the good ones and the classics, but they're really excited for the bad ones. Listen to Watch No Evil. You can find all of Redwood Sound Lab shows at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts.